Professor Julie Sanders is, as I say, Professor of English Literature and Drama at the University of Nottingham. And she's going to speak today on Ben Jonson, Bankside and Blackfriars, a biography of London theatre districts in the 17th century. Julie.
Thank you very much. Is that all right for audibility? Good. Okay. Just up a bit. Okay. So since this lecture series is entitled Shakespearean London Theatres, I'll start with a reference to Shakespeare himself, though perhaps filtered through some other great voices, the writing talent of James Joyce and his wonderful creation, the aspiring artist Stephen Dedalus. He of A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man and Ulysses fame. In episode 9 of Joyce's consciously epic 1922 novel, Ulysses, entitled Scylla and Charybdis, itself a knowing nod to Homer's Odyssey, Stephen Dedalus imagines Shakespeare walking in the city in which he has taken up residence as a professional writer. It is this hour of a day in mid-June, Stephen said, begging with a swift glance their hearing. The flag is up on the playhouse by the bankside. The bear Saccason growls in the pit near it, Paris Garden. Canvas climbers who sailed with Drake chew their sausages among the groundlings. Local colour, work in all you know. Make them accomplices. Shakespeare has left the Huguenot's house in Silver Street and walks by the Swan Mews along by the riverbank. But he does not stay to feed the pen, chivying her game of cygnets towards the rushes. The Swan of Avon has other thoughts. Composition of place, Ignatius Loyola, make haste to help me. And so the play begins. And of course we have Hamlet. Now I've grown ever more fascinated by this extract in Joyce's novel, as it seems to me he's in some sense playing with the kind of research and work I've myself have been trying to do over recent years, trying to think about writers in their own spaces and places. And it is the little details that intrigue me here, not least the reference to Saccason the bear, to whom I will return in a moment, or those ravenous canvas climbers, the working shipmen on the Thames, which was, of course, according to contemporary accounts by men like Donald Lupton, writing in 1632, a forest of masts at the time. So that's a view that would have been clearly visible to Shakespeare as he walked along Bankside on the kind of early summer's day that Joyce is imagining in the extract just quoted. I'm interested in the sights and the smells that creative writers like Shakespeare and like Ben Jonson, who's my ostensible subject today, Old Ben, as Joyce refers to him a little later in the passage, would have encountered on their daily circuits of the city in which they lived and practiced and wrote, and how that fed into their plays and into the ways in which their audiences, who walked the same streets, traversed the same waterways and bridges, experienced those plays when they were staged. So I call this kind of work cultural geography. And I'm hugely indebted to real cultural geographers who have helped me over recent years to think about space and place in terms not only of mapping and cartography, but of lived experience and flow, the flow of people, the flow of things, the flow of ideas. So one version of this talk today might describe it as a cultural geography, but I've opted for this term biography today, suggesting, I hope, that what I'm trying to tell is the story and life of a place or a series of places. That is the 17th century London theatres and what abutted them in terms of people, landscapes, traffic, noise, smells, sights and actions. And I'm interested in how the notion of, or sense of place is made from all these things and how that might help us as literary and theatre historians to recuperate a sense of lives lived hundreds of years ago. So it is part speculation, but it's also partly, I hope, an act of literary archaeology, reconstructing a bigger picture from the traces with which we are left. Traces in street patterns, in architecture, in plays and poems. Traces of London in the early part of the 17th century. And some of you will have noticed in the Joyce quotation that wonderfully knowing reference to Shakespeare leaving the Huguenots' house on Silver Street. And it's fascinating to find Joyce, of course, using trace material of Shakespeare's presence in London as part of the lodgers and the temporary itinerant livers that I'm going to suggest today were such an important part of the capital's geography at this time, a point reflected in many, many of the plays of the time. It's a story, temporary lodging, that also makes a contribution to Jonson's biography, not least as it was played out in the Blackfriars district. But it's, of course, also the material that Charles Nicoll used quite recently as the platform for his work of cultural geography, the biography of Shakespeare, The Lodger, which sought to reimagine Shakespeare's time in Silver Street by reconstructing with quite loving detail the world of wire workers and tire women among whom he would have moved. Shakespeare is noticeably shadowy in that text. It's the world around him that is built up for us. So, like James Joyce and like Charles Nicoll, I suppose I am interested in local colour and working it in. And I hope you'll be inspired after today to use that wonderful walking map produced by the project to traverse some of these sites for yourself, to pace the same paths and to walk in Jonson's footsteps, as it were. And I'm focusing on Jonson partly because he's a personal obsession, but also because he's usually credited with being the great writer of the urban psychology, a phrase used by Martin Butler, who is one of the lecturers you will hear from towards the end of this series. But I want to think today about when the theatres were at their most active. Martin will be talking about the end of the theatres, as it were, the closing of the commercial playhouses in 1642. And I want to think about theatres on two sides of the River Thames, on the Banks side, where the larger outdoor amphitheatres like the Globe, the Rose and the Swan plied their trade, and also the city after 1600, when the Blackfriars and the other indoor or private playhouses, as they're sometimes called, began to make their mark in commercial London theatre practice. So the idea is, I hope, to take you on a short but instructive perambulation of the Bankside and Blackfriars precincts, the two main theatre districts in which Shakespeare and Jonson saw out their professional playwriting careers, to think about what surrounded and abutted the indoor playing houses and the outdoor amphitheatres, to think about what sites, audience members and playwrights would have passed through on their way to and from a playhouse, and how those experiences surely would have impacted on their expectations of and responses to the plays they witnessed inside. So I want to start with Bankside, bricks and bears. Jonson is a London man. He was the stepson of a bricklayer who worked in the Hartsorn Lane, Charing Cross region. He was apprenticed into the trade as a young man into the Tylers and Bricklayers Company, which had been given its Royal Charter in 1568. This was something that was much to the amusement of many of Jonson's theatre rivals. They made endless punning references to him being a brickie in their plays. I do like knowing that fact about him, though, that he had handwork experience, that he knew what manual work was like, so that when he wrote about artisans like Cobb the waterman or others in Every Man in His Humour, he understood what it meant to be a hand worker in the London streets. In fact, quite literally, his presence may still be traced in some of the London walls. The night before my PhD viva 300 years ago, I remember going off to try and find Jonson in Poet's Corner, and I had to ask them to move all the chairs that had been stacked in front of the poor soul. But I think he was probably more present somewhere outside in those walls. But for a moment, let's put bricks and mortars to one side and return to those bears. The English monarchy had an official bear ward, an officer in charge of the bears, bulls and mastiff dogs, at least from the reign of Richard III onwards. And in 1604, Philip Henslowe, entrepreneur manager of the Rose Theatre on Bankside, or Geoffrey Rush in Shakespeare in Love, as my students tend to know him better, had a financial interest in bear baiting, at least from 1594. And his son-in-law, the Rose Theatre's star actor Edward Alleyn, or Ben Affleck, who had particularly made his name as the protagonist in the great Marlowe parts of Faustus and Barabbas, purchased the royal office of the mastership for £450, and they maintained the practice of animal baiting there. Henslow bought Allen out in 1611, and in 1613, Henslow and a new business partner, Jacob Mead, tore down the Bear Garden on Bankside and replaced it with what became known as the Hope Theatre in 1614 onwards. And the Hope was equipped as a dual-purpose venue. It hosted both stage plays and animal sports. And though gradually over time fewer plays were staged there, the Hope was generally still known by the name the Bear Garden after its primary use. One of the plays we know to have been staged very early in the Hope's life is Jonson's Bartholomew Fair. And right at the beginning, we have a sort of framing induction to the play where a bookholder, i.e. the person in the theatre company who would have secured the licences for play text and supervised casting and rehearsals, has a sort of meta-theatrical exchange with a stagekeeper, the stagekeeper being the kind of dog's body or gopher employee who would have kept a working theatre house going, who would have kept the stage clean, would have attached playbills to posts to advertise individual shows, and who might even have swelled the scene as an extra in a crowd scene or two. And they make reference to the stage being littered with bits of apple, presumably thrown by members of the audience, and the idea that these might be recycled as food for the bears in the pit. Your judgment, rascal, for what? Sweeping the stage or gathering up the broken apples for the bears within? That play, of course, Bartholomew Fair, also features the wonderful character of Ursula, a very large fair worker, referred to by another character as a she-bear, a reference to the practices of Bartholomew Fair itself, which did indulge in regular occasions in bear baiting, but again asking the audience in the Hope to think about that space's multiple use and associations. And some of you will know about the 2008 excavations in the area, which of course uncovered remains of dogs, horses, and indeed bears dating back to the 17th century, perhaps traces of Hope performances of another kind. So in thinking about the importance of geography and mapping then, we need to note the proximity of the Bear Gardens to the sites of the Rose and the Globe and what that might mean. The sights and the sounds, but also this idea of an analogous form of entertainment. Spaces being literally collapsed into one another. The Globe, and especially the Hope, being used for baitings and then for performances of early modern plays at different times of the day. I think it messes with our heads about what the status of theatre at this time might have been. Of course, it was also a very rich field of metaphor for the sensitive playwright. You've got the Bartholomew Fair example there on the screen, but I have to mention, of course, Macbeth. In the fifth and final act of that tragedy, as Macduff and the forces of Birnam Wood bear in on Macbeth, he refers to himself as a baited bear. And audiences in the Globe would surely have collapsed this moment into direct experience and memory they might themselves have of Bankside bear baitings or of the sight of the bears they might have passed on the way to the theatre that day. They've tied me to a stake. I cannot fly, but bear-like I must fight the course. Of course, bears were also a source of material for comedy. In Jonson's 1609 play, Epicene, a play I'll come back to, Captain Otter and his bear, bull, and dog cups are a wonderful telling story of a man who, though he is living in the city now, across the River Thames, dreams actually of the spaces of Southwark where he was able to drink himself into oblivion on regular evenings, much to the disdain of his aspirational wife, a china shop owner, Mistress Otter. So he sits there with his cups, the bear, the bull, and the dog, and remembers these other spaces. So the city as a whole, as I hope I'm beginning to register, was a space to be confronted and to be moved through. It's at the heart of much of the dramatic and social satire of this period, and not least Ben Jonson's. In Epicene, the city is used as a veritable weapon with which to beat one particular character, the obsessional Morose. Morose fetishizes silence, and he's of course chosen the wrong city to live in. He lives on one of the busiest thoroughfares of London at the time. Eventually in the play, he kind of retreats to the highest point of the house in an effort to get away from the noise. And in that play, another character called Truewit hires bear wards to stand under Morose's window with their dogs and quite literally to make a racket. The action of Truewit gives us access there not only to the perverse enjoyment of Jonson the satirist at Morose's distress, and the play seems to revel in Morose's distress throughout, but a very vivid sense of what the actual noises, sights, and sounds of the early modern city might have been. Because bear wards did parade the streets of London on regular occasions. They advertised upcoming shows, and you'll hear some more about that kind of forms of advertising and theatre playbills in Tiffany Stern's lecture a little bit later in the series, in fact, later this month. So we're transported by this reference in Epicene to the bear-baiting sites of the Bankside, and in particular to the Paris or the Bear Gardens, where Tom Otter preferred to spend his time. Morose's pathological objection to the daily soundscape of the city in Epicene paints for us a very detailed picture of its quotidian practices, the babel of languages that are to be heard in the law courts of Westminster, to the coaches, the bells, and the street criers of the city's narrow thoroughfares, to its waterside wharves, its thriving markets, and its theatres, a great source of noise in their own right. And so once again, we can see Johnson drawing for us the landscape of his city in the most vivid possible ways. In a belfry, at Westminster Hall, in the cockpit, at the fall of a stag, the Tower Wharf, London Bridge, Paris Garden, Billingsgate, when the noises are at their height and loudest. Nay, I would sit out a play that were nothing but fights at sea, drum, trumpet, and target. So just to stick with these bear-baiting practices for a moment longer as a sort of suggestive way of trying to imagine life in and around the Bankside and the theatres in which Johnson and Shakespeare staged their work in the early parts of their careers, you've got two types, really, of bear-baiting that took place. The bear tied to the stake, which is what you heard of in that Macbeth reference, and the blinded bear. Many of you will remember the horrific scene of Gloucester's blinding in King Lear, and I've been thinking recently about how that scene had its own sort of physical and visceral associations, and Gloucester describes himself as being tied to the stake, standing the course. If you've just seen a blinded bear being taunted a few yards down the road, how striking might such a reference be? The use of dogs was common, and bulls were also baited and taunted in this way. We think that it's the staked version that was particularly connected to the bear gardens, but we also know that it wasn't about killing the bears. Individual bears had status. Just like an Edward Alleyn or a Richard Burbage, they were star actors, as it were. They were names. They were celebrities. People came especially to see them. One was Harry of Warwick, which seems quite deliberately to conjure cognitive associations with the history plays that Alleyn and others had been making such a success on the Bankside in the 1590s. And Sackerson, the bear referred to in the Joyce extract, is just one more such example of a celebrity bear. You didn't want to kill off your star attraction. So these were very highly stage-managed affairs. One of my students recently compared it to worldwide wrestling. You need to protect your star. So John Davies wrote a poem that referred to how the Inns of Court trainee lawyers were neglecting their studies to see old Harry Hunks and Sackerson. And Sackerson's also the bear mentioned in Merry Wives of Windsor, where a character claims, "I have seen Sackerson loose 20 times." It tells you how quite how often these star actors were rolled out. One of the things, if you do use the walking map produced by the project, and Maurice and I were talking about this just before the lecture, is by walking around you realise the proximity of many of these sites. Things were very close. They were tumbled in upon each other. So, of course, the Inns of Court is very near to many of the indoor theatres. In turn, the Bear Garden is so close to the Rose and the Globe and so on that people were crisscrossing these sites and reading them against each other all the time. So bears were a form of theatre in themselves. People paid to see them, even when they were resting, as it were, in their cages and pits in the bear gardens and not officially being baited. And some of you will know that there are traces of such pits in Sheffield still today, and some in the Peaks, hidden in estate country gardens. We mostly think that it was black bears that were used, and we reckon that there were about 10 to 12 of them in the Paris or Bear Gardens at any one time, and about 150 dogs kennelled there. But we also know that there were polar bears at one stage. Two polar bear cubs were a special attraction following their having been gifted to Henslow after being presented to King James VI and I by the Muscovy Company. They had killed the mother of the cubs on a hunting trip in Greenland in 1609, and there are actually accounts some years later of the polars being made to swim in the Thames while being pursued by dogs for, again, the attraction of the watching audiences, a different kind of river theatre to that which we often imagine. And there's been related speculation about bears in plays at this time. Many of you, of course, will know that famous stage direction of Shakespeare's Exit Pursued by a Bear. Critical speculation has asked us to think about whether real bears could have been used. Of course, what it's also connecting to is the royal masks, a form of theatre at the other end of the spectrum from bear baiting that Jonson was also involved in, the most sort of elite form of theatre. This is Inigo Jones, who of course co-designed many of the royal masks with Jonson. We certainly know that a number of masks allude to bears, seem to have bear characters. Now, whether we want to believe, as some critics have suggested, that these really were the polar bears trotted out for performance, which I have my doubts about, the point is they're in the metaphorical ether. They're part of what people are seeing and can therefore bring to bear when they see these spectacular and fantastical events at court. So we're talking about entertainments that range across the whole spectrum of rank and power, and Jonson is interesting because he traverses all of those sites. Royal masks from 1605 onwards are very much associated with Jonson and with Inigo Jones, his great sparring partner, if you like. They argued ferociously for most of the time. And Jones is interesting too because he's a theatre designer, but he's also an architect. So he's another person whose traces are very present in the streets and sights of London. Many of you will know Jones in association with the banqueting house where the masks were performed, and many will also know that he was mocked and parodied by Jonson in characters like Lantern Leatherhead, who is the puppet master of Bartholomew Fair, showing his puppets in the canvas booths. By the 1630s, Jones would have designed the Covent Garden Piazza in the Italianate style. But many people have referred to the fact that you can stand in Covent Garden even today and feel how strongly that work was influenced by his own theatrical experience, by the sight lines and the reveals and the perspectives of masks. And you can see here how the sort of perspective layout with the stage and where the king would have been seated and so on. D.J. Gordon has actually suggested that you could describe Covent Garden as a theatrical quotation, which I think is rather wonderful. So all the time then, we're in this kind of biography, witnessing theatre being shaped by the city, but the city in turn being shaped by theatre. Bartholomew Fair, with its depiction of London, the Smithfield Fair held annually in August, its roasting pigs, its gambling, its gingerbread men, its pickpockets, its ballad singers, its puppet shows, and its prostitutes, and the stage really is that busy, shows you Jonson as a writer, bringing a particular form into being, which is city comedy. Along with Thomas Middleton, Jonson is perhaps most readily associated with this particular genre. He rewrote Every Man in His Humour in 1616 to move it, to relocate it from Florence to London, as he sort of marked how popular, how much of a trend this type of theatre was becoming. Theatre that told Londoners about its own sites and spaces, that showed London back to Londoners. I suppose it all began around about 1605 with the collaborative play Eastward Ho, for which you can see the title page there, which Jonson co-wrote with John Marston and George Chapman. Marston, of course, himself an Inns of Court man, also walking these sites and spaces. Swiftly, it was followed by Epicene, which I've already mentioned, in 1609, a play located largely on the Strand, which was a kind of growing thoroughfare between the city proper and the court. So it's where people would buy lodgings, take lodgings if they were sort of aspirational for a court position. So if you like, what Epicene maps out is a geography of aspiration, a geography of desire, from the aforementioned Mistress Otter, the china shop woman, dreaming of being a city alderman's wife, to the would-be courtiers, the wonderfully named Sir John Dore and Sir Amorous Le Fool, who take very expensive lodgings in order to be seen on the Strand. So I'm making very fleeting references to a whole host of plays today, partly to try and indicate just how embedded Jonson was as a writer in these sites and spaces. I hope they're plays that you might get a chance to see over the next few years. 1616 is a very big date. I understand it has something to do with William Shakespeare, but it was also the year in which Johnson published his monumental folio works, and Greg Doran at least has promised that the RSC will recognise that fact with some new productions, so let's hope he gets a look in the repertoire. Johnson then is associated with the traversal of many city domains, not only in his plays, but in his own biography. He lived across three reigns, and I think that makes him very interesting in itself, writing right through Elizabethan, Jacobean, and into the Caroline period. He worked in both professional and private capacities. He worked for commercial theatre, and he worked at the court, and he worked in the provinces. He was also a walker. So we can expect that he did traverse these sites and spaces, because we also know that in 1618 he walked from London to Edinburgh, so crossing from Blackfriars to Bankside was no problem for him. Place and movement, then, are very important to this biography. And that's why I'm asking you, as it were, in your imagination, and then hopefully with the map itself afterwards, to walk around, because I think that kinetic, practiced understanding of a site and of theatre as part of a wider neighbourhood or district is important. I love a tiny moment in Johnson's 1616 play, The Devil is an Ass, when a character called Witty Poll woos a married woman, Frances Fitzdottrell. Now, in one remarkable scene, he tries to woo her and even to physically seduce her, while he's standing in a room in one house and she's standing pinioned in her own, the virtual prisoner of a very overweening husband. Now, that kind of boggles the mind slightly. How can that happen? Well, these are the stage directions. Enter Witty Poll and Manley, and as the modern editor of the Cambridge edition tells us, at the window of Manley's chamber opposite Fitzdottrell's house. Witty Poll, this must be the very window and that the room. Now, what we do is we realise that he can touch Frances Fitzdottrell, because if you're standing in the upper stories of crowded London tenement housing, they are almost touching each other. They're banking over. They're coming that close. So in a single moment on the stage, and in a kind of cluster of stage directions that we might otherwise glance over quite quickly, Johnson conjures the built environment of his audience. But he also tells us about a time of rapid urban growth, about housing issues, about social overcrowding, and about the tensions that result. That is an original stage direction. Before we leave the Bankside, then, it's worth reflecting on how the space, size, and scale of the outdoor theatres themselves also impact on Johnson's work, the space inside the theatre as well as the spaces outside the theatre. Tiffany Stern has herself argued that these larger stages, like the Globe and the Hope, enabled Johnson to situate his plays in recognisably large, crowd-filled sites. And you can see something like that happening with Bartholomew Fair, a very busy play full of characters, canvas booths, lots of activity. There's something about the way in which these spaces themselves encourage a way of writing that is about ensemble scenes, that is about bringing the crowd scenes onto the stage. Literally in Bartholomew Fair, in terms of bodies, perhaps more in a play like Epicene, which has moved into the indoor theatres, though, a memory of that in what is offstage. And perhaps what we start to think about as we move over to the Blackfriars and to the indoor theatres is the way in which the offstage becomes as resonant as the space of the stage itself. Okay, so having wandered along like Joyce's version of Shakespeare on a summer's day, having wandered along the Bankside and thought about bears and bricks, I'm now going to ask you to reach into your pockets and pay the waterman's fare to get across the water, across the Thames, to the Blackfriars Wharf, and we'll start to walk around this slightly different space and place that makes up the precinct in which the second Blackfriars indoor theatre stood. And then towards the end, I'll take you back across the river for a view from the other side, as it were, of this domain. My colleague, Jeanette Dillon, has argued that Johnson writes about London in the way he does, partly because he works largely for the Blackfriars Theatre in the latter decades of his career, and because that theatre's audience included many young lawyers from the nearby Inns of Court who enjoyed hearing about themselves, so it made sense to make the most of your local geography, the local colour. Now, I've called this section of the talk here in the Friars. And that's, of course, a quote from Jonson's 1610 play, The Alchemist, a piece of theatre very consciously written for and eventually staged in the Blackfriars precinct by a playwright who we know was resident there himself. The Alchemist actually had its first performance in Oxford in the end due to an outbreak of plague in London, which is another aspect of London life I haven't gone into any detail about today, but of course which is also shaping practices and understandings in crucial ways. Epicene is actually staged in 1609, just after a very serious plague outbreak, and one of the noises that haunts Morose is the ringing of the bells for the dead. As well as having a family home in the Blackfriars, we know that Jonson appears, at least for a part of his time, to have taken temporary lodgings in the household of the Scottish courtier, Esme Stuart, Seigneur d'Aubigny, possibly as early as 1603, when d'Aubigny had just come to London, having come down from Edinburgh with the new king, with James VI of Scotland, when he came down to be crowned King James I of England. And Jonson was certainly in residence in the Blackfriars in 1607, when he authors the epistle to the 1607 quarto edition of his play Volpone. Stuart himself was lodged in the former Lord Cobham's house, which had been forfeited to the Crown in 1603, and it was very near to Playhouse Yard and the site of the Blackfriars Theatre. Ian Donaldson, in his recent wonderful biography of Jonson, notes that Stuart was often away on business, so Jonson would at times have had the spacious house in the Blackfriars to himself. And Donaldson has great fun speculating on the way that this feeds into the plot line of The Alchemist, where you've got the servant of the household basically holding sway and causing havoc while the master is away on his Kentish estates due to a plague outbreak. The rich could get away when plague came out in London. They could get away to their country estates. The poor had to stay and face the consequences. So we could think about Jonson then in this respect as a very significant part of the transient yet significant practices of London neighbourhoods, which was encouraged by this world of taking temporary lodgings, and it's the same life we see Shakespeare living on Silver Street. Alchemist is a play about a takeover of a house, so it tells you about temporary lodgings and the kinds of nefarious practices that might go on in such a context. And as I've already mentioned, it's a world brilliantly created by Charles Nicholl in The Lodger. In a Blackfriars context, though, Shakespeare tellingly re-emerges as a property purchaser in 1613 of the Eastern Gatehouse near St Andrew's Hill. And the deed, which you can see up here, describes it thus. I'm not going to read you the whole thing, but all that dwelling house or tenement with the appurtenances situate and being within the precinct, circuit and compass of the late Blackfriars London, and now or late being in the tenure or occupation of William Ireland, and we still call it Ireland's Yard today, and I notice a contemporary estate agent selling a plot of land on there, making great play of the fact that it had these associations. So it still makes money. Abutting upon a street and leading down to Puddle Wharf on the east part, right against the King's Majesty's wardrobe. Come back to that. Now, possibly Shakespeare was never resident here himself. Graham Holderness has indicated that it's perhaps just part of those glimpses that make up a very fragmentary biography that we all as critics like to insert our own versions of Shakespeare into. But certainly this was bought with other trustees, including a vintner and someone associated with the Mermaid Tavern. Perhaps it was just a business venture, though that's interesting in itself. Shakespeare as businessman, Shakespeare as entrepreneur, coming very clearly into visibility again. Perhaps he was intending to make money from a rental property of his own. He knew that this would be a significant place for actors, for players. But he was also at this time, of course, undertaking reasonably significant writing collaborations with John Fletcher, and he certainly paid a fairly high price for the market of the day, so maybe it's feasible that he even intended to use it as a London bolt hole near to the theatre of the day. Whatever the truth, then, over a couple of decades, we have the two most significant dramatists of the period located quite literally in and within the streets and soundscapes of Blackfriars. The narrow streets, which petitioners claimed were regularly blocked or made hazardous by the coaches bringing theatregoers to see plays, within striking distance of the water stairs and the wharf and the passing fares and calls of the Thames watermen. These things all then reappear on the stages of the Blackfriars and other theatres like St Paul's. The Blackfriars neighbourhood, we know, housed actors and players too. Joseph Taylor, who was Face in the Blackfriars Alchemist, was probably born and baptised here at St Andrew's by the Wardrobe. Nobles like William Cavendish appear to have taken townhouses in the district at certain times, and we know, of course, Johnson's long and important connection with that family. It's all something to think about when we try to pin down the geography of a playhouse, to think about these people passing through, living nearby, and what they might have been, might have brought to the character of a neighbourhood. Lena Cohen-Orlin has talked about these temporary lodgings, and she's created this rather wonderful sort of three-part distinction of all, she says, that was interim, makeshift, and exigent. And she talks about the existence of these elite sojourners, you know, like Johnson residing in Daubigny's house, nobles and courtiers who rent properties in this area. Perhaps the world that Shakespeare hopes to create a revenue stream from when he takes that property of the gatehouse in 1613. But also lodgings are sites of indigence, of downward mobility and vice, the repurposing of the house that the alchemist tells us the story of. And quite simply, simple rental income. Lodgings as an income stream for the middling sort as well as the working poor. There's a wonderful play by Richard Broome, one of Johnson's protégés, in 1635 called The Asparagus Garden, which is all about what happens when you have lodgers in your house who overhear your marital arguments. So what I hope this talk begins to indicate is that this was a very rich neighbourhood, that there's no single monolithic way of describing the Blackfriars, that there were elite and popular practices cheek by jowl with one another in various ways. Johnson feeds off that kind of raw material right through his career. In 1632, for example, he writes a play called The Magnetic Lady, which has a lot of sort of medicinal content, and is building directly on the fact that in the same year, the Society for the Apothecaries had moved in next door, as it were, next door to the theatre. So I'm really interested in what I'm calling the power of the proximate, the power of the nearby, the abutting spaces, which deeds of property are so interesting for in what they tell us about the wider experience of space and place in this period. So just for the last 10 minutes or so, I'm going to try and talk about some particular sites in the Blackfriars that fed into these spatial stories of drama and hopefully inspire you, as I say, to take a perambulation of your own. So as with the Bankside, where we thought about those bear gardens and bear pits and what it might have been to walk past and see those sights or hear the noises of the growling bears, walking around or towards the Blackfriars might have thrown up some rather different sights and sounds. You enter the theatre itself proper through a portal on Carter Lane, but I'm going to concentrate on three key prospects or orientations close by the theatre which feed into the cultural geography of the plays that were staged there. And I want to think about the Royal Wardrobe. St. Andrew by the Wardrobe, the church, has already been mentioned, and its own name talks about its proximity to the Royal Wardrobe on the eastern side. And Sarah Dustagir, who's in the audience here today, has written a very wonderful thesis that in part looks at things like the connecting bridge and the textiles that would have travelled back and forth across that bridge and what the sight and sound of that might have meant for plays like Cynthia's Revels by Johnson. Bridewell, the former royal palace, but of course by now a house of correction on the western side, also had a connecting bridge, an architectural residue, if you like, of its former rather grander persona. And then to the south of the river itself, the Fleet Ditch and the Thames, resonant adjacent locales to the theatre. And what's important is this flow, this movement between all of these spaces and back again, what geographer Tim Cresswell would call place-making activity. So we could think about the Wardrobe, for example. In 1629, Johnson writes another Blackfriars Theatre play, The New Inn, which as well as being a fascinating play about in-house culture, is full of tailors and costumes and fabrics and the delivery and misdelivery of dresses. Like Cynthia's Revels then, I think we can see this as a play directly impacted by the surrounding geography of the theatre, that bridge between the Great Wardrobe and the Precinct, the site of fabric and textiles. And it suggests that this daily site of material on the move fed into the play stages in fascinating ways. But of course also an attendant textile and craft industry grew up in the neighbourhood. Any sort of thick description, which is what an anthropologist would strive to make of the region or the neighbourhood, would want to take into account the number of people around here doing and working in clothing-related crafts, feather makers, silk workers. And Sarah talks in her thesis about the relevance of the local clothing industry to the spatial practice of costume and jewellery on the Blackfriars stage. Jean Howard, another lecturer in the series, has written about why the Blackfriars were so keen to show new costumes and new objects, that it was up with the fashions of the day, as it were. It became a kind of catwalk for the new and the avant-garde. And you can see that right through from something like Eastwood Ho in 1605, right through to something like Massinger's The City Madam in 1632. These are deeply localised plays, right down to the material culture of what's on stage, the properties and the costumes. And you can see here in the Thomas Randolph quote from 1630, these ideas are existing again. This is a play actually first performed in Cambridge, though probably then produced by the Children of the Queen's Revels at the Salisbury Court Indoor Theatre. But the play opens with all the ambiguities of belief and practice of a precinct like the Blackfriars, where Puritans live, who presumably object to the theatre, but who are making their living from providing the very wares that the theatre needs. Two of the sanctified fraternity of the Blackfriars. The pins that they have bought for sale are tiny objects, of course, but as material culture, they connect us to the daily practices, negotiations, compromises and ingenuities of the precinct's communities. And there's a deep value, I think, in identifying the relationships between goods and social groups and how staged goods can retell some of these spatial stories. And all you have to do is make a trip to the Museum of London and see the wonderful little pile of pins that were excavated in the Rose archaeology to start to tell that story, to imagine what they came from. I suspect probably from the pins of the dresses of people in the audience, but it's a lovely story about how available and present such objects were. So in this way, then, the wares of the Blackfriars labourers connect with the world of the royal wardrobe and in turn intervene in the world of the plays staged in the Blackfriars. Bridewell, the brick house of castigation by the river, as one playwright described it, a rather different proximate but equally suggestive site to the wardrobe, formerly a royal palace but now a house of correction. It's the historian Paul Griffiths' epic work on what he calls Lost Londons, the worlds and indeed words of the metropolis's underworlds of crime and criminality, that I think helped to give us the strongest sense of what a dominant and sensory site the Bridewell would have been and how prevalent it would have been on what I'm calling the effective landscape of the Blackfriars precinct. You could not have ignored it walking around. You could not have ignored it, in fact, even coming by on water, very, very visible from a boat, and we've got a number of contemporary descriptions that reflect on that. It had been the main lockup for petty criminals since 1555, but was also a storehouse of resources, grain, coal. The site even had its own lime kilns, and the occupants were made to do hard labour, to work both within and without its walls. Many were involved in dredging the Thames twice daily, so they were very visible, these inhabitants of Bridewell, on the physical urban landscape as people walked around. Bridewell is, in Paul Griffiths' stunning account, a repository for all the vagrants, peddlers, tricksters, night walkers, hawkish landlords and surly porters, who of course also become the dramatis personae of city comedy, and so many Blackfriars plays. Griffiths links them to modes of movement, there's that word again, movement, streets, not being known, being lost, making ends meet, sinking. Such a striking bit of writing. Movement, streets, not being known, being lost, making ends meet, sinking. There's a kind of story of city comedy in there. A poetic of hardship that is compelling and which hovers at the edge of so many of the plays of the period. Bridewell was notable for its public whippings of half-stripped women. It was also notable for its apprenticing of children into hard labour. It's the threat of that fate that hangs so audibly over Doll Common in The Alchemist. She's constantly worrying about someone coming to take her away to Bridewell. It finds voice then on the stages of Middleton and Johnson and Thomas Dekker. Eastwood Ho is again a useful reference point. In Act 4, Scene 1, that remarkable scene that begins with Slitgut, the butcher's boy, up a pole, taking in a whole panorama of Cuckold's Haven and the Isle of Dogs. It's also a scene in which characters are constantly seen engaging with the local constabulary and being threatened with being carried to Bridewell. And that's what I mean by the resonant offstage space. It's never literally the setting in plays like Eastwood Ho, but it's there all the time. In The Alchemist, from the minute there's an initial knock on the door, it's there in the thoughts and associations of the characters. And if you've just passed it, if you've just seen it on the way to the theatre, how more resonant is that association? Edward Sharpham's The Fleer is a Blackfriars play from 1607 that has much to say about whores and prostitution and therefore alludes to Bridewell in numerous contexts. Lording Barry's Ram Alley from 1608 talks about a wife who's escaped to Fleet Bridge and wondering how they escaped unseen. They went by the Greyhound and so struck into Bridewell. It becomes a kind of sanctuary for those trying to hide. So geographies of proximity again. These particular buildings, actual and imaginative, are resources within walking distance of the theatre. They're part of a significant offstage geography that we need to acknowledge. In John Day's play The Isle of Gulls, performed at Blackfriars in 1606, several players and agents quite literally get thrown into the Bridewell for their scurrilous portrayal of royalty. The edges of imaginative and cultural geography and harsh reality then blur, and actual play means actual playwrights going to Bridewell. And I wanted to just briefly draw your attention to a play that's probably less well known to some of you, which is The Honest Whore, Part 2, second part of two plays authored by Decker and Middleton. Very odd blend of city comedy and domestic melodrama. Ostensibly, these plays are set in Milan, but it's a barely disguised 1604-6 London and Blackfriars district that we see. They weren't performed at the Blackfriars, but at the Fortune Theatre by the rival company of the Admiral's Men, but they took account of, they made knowing reference to the theatre, the Blackfriars Theatre and its repertoire, i.e. to the rival and the neighbourhood in which it was situated. The Honest Whore Part 1 ended in a very signifying space, that of Bedlam, Bethlehem Hospital, but it's the fifth act of Part 2 that concerns me because it ends up quite literally in the Bridewell, as the 1630 printed title page tells us. But of course it's the Italian Bridewell where the scene ends. A character called Lodovico brings the news of Bellafront the prostitute. Your nightingale is in a lime bush, your puritanical honest whore sits in a blue gown, he says, reference to the livery that would have been worn by Bridewell's residents, those women who would have been seen on the streets, a different kind of Blackfriars wardrobe, if you like, a different kind of catwalk or parade. But the way in which Lodovico's lines constantly engage with the built environment in this play are really striking and would have told any member of the audience that this is very definitely not Milan, but the Blackfriars neighbourhood and Bridewell. Do you know the brick house of castigation by the riverside that runs by Milan, the school where they pronounced Oletta well, but oh. And there's that soundscape again, the cries that would have been heard by people walking past the walls. And we know from lots of court depositions that that was exactly the soundscape that people responded to. There's mention there of the river, and I'll end with the River Thames in just a moment. I suppose what you've got here is this contact zone between the built environment and the liquid environment that's always so striking in London, the world of the Thames and its edges that people are constantly abutting and traversing on a daily basis. So the sensory geography of London is really important to this biography. Haptic, aural, olfactory, the smell of the river is something I am asking you to think about. It's also a tarscape, what the anthropologist Tim Ingold would use as a phrase to describe. It's a site of labour, a site of production, grinding mills, and so on. And this is the world described again by Lodovico. There you may have her at your will, for there she beats chalk or grinds in the mill with a whip, deedle, 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 little monkey. It's a throwaway line, but what it describes is horrific. And if you put that alongside the Bridewell records, it's a very different kind of geography it starts to tell us. At this point in the play, the master of Bridewell actually enters on stage, and there's a striking intervention from the Duke that describes the building and its architecture and its placement that makes you in no doubt of what's being described, but I like that moment of the ancient building beside the river's neighbourhood. And it's the river's neighbourhood that I'll just close on for the last couple of minutes. The collaboratively authored Boys' Company drama Eastward Ho is then another spatial connector to the river at this time. And I want to end with the Fleet Ditch and the River Thames. Many of you will know the fleet featured in Jonson's unforgettable poem On the Famous Voyage, which described the mock epic journey of two adventurers, Haydon and Sheldon, who sailed down the open sewer of London. I'm not going to go into too thick a description of that particular sensory geography for you, but you get the point. The fleet and beyond it the river found their way into the cultural geography of commercial drama in resonant ways. There are numerous plot lines that deal with clandestine escapes and flights from water stairs. There are numerous stories that involve watermen. You have plays like Arden of Faversham, which are all about postal and other kinds of traffic up and down the Thames. The trade and practice of the river's neighbourhood is a very important part of the geography of the theatres and the geography of the plays that are staged there. But having taken you for a walk around Blackfriars, I'm going to ask you to fish into your pockets just once again and to find the fare back over to Bankside just for a moment to pause and take in a prospect of the Blackfriars Theatre from the other side, as it were, from the vantage space and landscape of the Globe and its companion open-air playhouses. And in other contexts, I've been spending some time recently with the play A Chase Made in Cheapside by Thomas Middleton, which was performed in 1613 at the Swan. And what struck me in thinking about that play was Touchwood Senior's anecdote towards the start of Act 4, Scene 2, which is about a gentleman who gets attacked in the Blackfriars Theatre by some ruffians who perform their own particular theatre by candlelight. You're going to be hearing a bit, I think, from Martin White later in the series about the importance of the candlelit interior of the Blackfriars, but here it becomes a kind of slightly shady environment in which more nefarious practices can take place. Of course, this is being spoken not in an indoor candlelit theatre, but in the open-air broad daylight of the Swan, and there's perhaps something very knowing about that, the rival open-air theatres alluding back to just how dodgy the elite theatres across the river really are. Blackfriars, though, as I hope we've begun to see, is just as complex a district as Southwark. Existences and practices coexist cheek by jowl. There are significant courtiers, there are tradespeople, there are people servicing the court and the theatre district, there are actors, there are playwrights, there are residents, and there are itinerants. You heard how one scaped out of the Blackfriars, but a while since from two or three varlets came into the house with all their rapiers drawn, as if they'd dance a sword dance on the stage with candles in their hands like Chandler's ghosts, whilst the poor gentleman, so pursued and bandied, was by an honest pair of oars safely landed. Of course, this is spoken by an honest pair of oars, the waterman, and some people have suggested that Middleton was trying to curry favour with those rather important figures on the Thames through this. But whatever, the performance that these varlets perform here in highly ironised fashion draws attention to the playing conditions of the indoor playhouse, the use of music and dance, the interact entertainments, the enhanced opportunity in a candlelit space for ghost scenes and apparitions. It's a wonderful moment of drawing our attention to what theatre can do. But it is, of course, a view from across the water. This is a panel from one of the royal masks I was mentioning, in fact, from Coelum Britannicum, another Inigo Jones, John Webb sketch for one of those panels, and it shows you the view from Southwark back across the river to the district of the Blackfriars, connecting then the two spaces and places I've asked you to think about. I hope it's helped to bring those spaces a bit closer together. I think we sometimes talk about the outdoor theatres over on the Bankside as if they were a million miles away from the indoor theatres of Blackfriars, but these spaces are being crisscrossed all the time, and that's part of the richness, part of the excitement of these plays. Now, I'm very influenced by the work of a geographer called Bill Cronin, who wrote a fantastic book on 19th century Chicago called Nature's Metropolis, a really path-breaking work, in which he suggested that any metropolitan site, any one district, ward or neighbourhood within it, depends on flow, in and out, of people, of goods, of ideas, of politics, of culture, of things, and of words. and there was flow of all kinds across the water between the indoor and the outdoor playing houses. And I hope that feels like a suggested enough point at which to end our journey today. Johnson, as I hope to have persuaded you, is just one wonderful example of the kinds of flows that I am gesturing at here, a fantastic point of entry into the neighbourhoods and suburbs of London as they developed and as they evolved through the early 17th century. If you do need to get back to the Blackfriars, though, you're on your own with those watermen. Our funding doesn't stretch that far. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Julie, for that. It's provoking and encouraging and suggestive and all the rest of it about the adjacency of drama and the street, I think, sums it up partly. And thanks for suggesting that people take their own perambulation using the map and referring to some of the other lectures that are upcoming, particularly Tiffany Stern's in 2 weeks' time. We're going to have some questions now, I hope. I'm sure you've got plenty to ask Julie, who'll stay there and receive them. Can I just mention one thing that came up in your lecture? You mentioned Eastwood Ho quite a few times. One of our outputs, and there's James, the director of these, the stage director of involved in these films. We've got one. We've got 5 10-minute films that are being made. They've been shot, they're being edited at the moment. And at the heart of them is our extracts from plays across this whole period. And one of the extracts is from Eastwood Ho. And it's come out really, really well, actually. And all of these films will be available on our website and probably on YouTube and other streaming sites by July, probably. So can we have any questions to Julie in that provoking lecture? There's a mic that will go around, and I'll hand over this other one so that you can use it. When you stand up and ask your question, don't be shy, please. Could you just stand up and say your name and speak directly into the mic, because we are recording all the questions and the answers. And an audio version of this exchange will be, an audio copy of it will be on the website very soon after it's happened today, I think. Okay. First question. There you go.
Victor Keegan, Shakespeare's London iPhone at Pardew. Do we not know any house that he actually lived in?
Johnson's house?
Yeah.
Johnson. So, well, the Cobbins house is the one that we're certain about. So,
sorry?
Daubigny's house is the one that we're most certain about, but the actual time length that he's there is disputed by various critics. Ian Donaldson suggests that actually it's quite a lengthy stay that he has in Daubigny's place.
Do we know the actual site of Daubigny's house?
Yes.
Whereabouts is it?
I can't tell you exactly. I don't have a map, sorry. But I can certainly pinpoint it for you. There's a map in Ian's biography, which will show you where that is.
Thank you.
And his father's house was Hartshorn. His stepfather's house was Hartshorn Lane. So we know that the Charing Cross district is one that he knew as a very young man. We're not entirely clear where he seems to have resided with Anne, his wife, or not resided with Anne, his wife, in the Blackfriars.
Thank you.
Another question? You must be burning to ask a question, some of you, or even smouldering. Andy.
Sorry, Andy Gurr. I've got a caveat and two names to put to you. The caveat is what you talk about, the power of proximity. And I'm a bit concerned about what goes on in terms of proximity. between people actually knowing one another and doing things with one another, which is why I want to raise two names. One of them, of course, is Richard Field, who was not unknown to Shakespeare, being a fellow Stratfordian, and who lived in the Blackfriars for quite a few years after, in fact, while Shakespeare was at Mountjoy Street on the north side. And the question really is how much he might have had to do with Richard Field during those years, because that would give him obvious familiarity with the Blackfriars long before he bought his own share of a property there. The other name is a bit more obscure and more intriguing to me. It's Sanders, the man who wrote the letter that was thought to have prompted the account of the shipwreck of the Sea Venture in the Bermudas, which may or may not have something to do with the tempest and the storm that opened the tempest. Sanders, we know, was living, said openly he was living in the Blackfriars through the period when the Boy Company was there, and was, in fact, he reckoned he was going two or three times a week to the second Blackfriars Playhouse to gain revenue from his share in the company there. And he obviously knew Ben Jonson there, because he wrote one of the commendatory poems, didn't he, for The Alchemist, I think it was. So there is a direct connection between Jonson and Sanders. But was there a connection between Jonson and Sanders and Shakespeare? The point being, of course, that the letter he wrote about the Sea Venture, if Shakespeare saw it, he must have seen it in manuscript long before it appeared in print. So you've got possibilities, but I wonder if the power of proximity really tells you anything more than just suggesting a proximity that may or may not have been important.
Yeah, it's interesting. I suppose I'm interested in proximity in a couple of ways. So there's proximity of built environment and what that does in terms of practice and movement, and that's one particular thing. So the site sounds, you know, there's something about what's abutting there, but you're right, then it's about the people and the communities that move through that. And what's interesting, and I suppose what I'm still grappling with, is that there are some things that seem more fixed and some things that seem more transient, and mapping those relationships. So part of what I call mapping the terrain is trying to work that out. In a different project at the moment, I suppose I'm thinking a lot with Jonson's Walk to Scotland about who he's meeting there. And one of the great powers of the digital, I hope, is that when we start to produce not just a linear map of going from A to B to C, but actually who you're encountering and what other spaces and places, and that brings us back to London and to some of the Blackfriars people through the Cavendish network, through the Roaths, through a number of others. So I think that's interesting. How do we know? It's a really good point, but it is tantalising, you're right. And I think there's a mapping to be done of the kind of trade, the companies and their presence here, people representing that kind of movement as well, which is really interesting. So it's very tantalising. It'd be nice to kind of, as I say, there's a bit of speculation in this, but nevertheless, I sort of think about the work that, say, Deborah Harkness has done in other contexts around the kind of scientific neighbourhoods and the neighbourhoods of kind of herbal practice. And the more you do that thick description, the more the relationships seem to emerge. Now, they may be meetings, how much they're sustained relationships is something we need to build, but I dream of trying to map somewhere like the Blackfriars digitally that would enable us to see who is where at different times, because proximity is also simultaneity. It's about what's going on at the same time in the same place, and maybe that draws people together. They may not necessarily be physically spending lots of time together, but if their dialogues or the conversations about them are crossing as well, that's part of the story. So that's really helpful. Thank you, and I'll think about that a bit more.
Over here.
Hello, Bernice Bailey. Before the lecture started, my husband was telling me that there was one of the theatres on the Blackfriars that had mainly child actors. Do you know anything about that?
Sorry, I didn't quite hear that. Apologies.
Oh, sorry. Before the lecture started, my husband was talking about one of the theatres on the Blackfriars that had mainly child actors. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, so the early incarnation of the Blackfriars is is as a children's only company theatre, and then the second Blackfriars becomes with adult players, and wonderful work done by people not me, including Andy, in the room on that. So, and some of these plays are for the children's company. Johnson writes for a mix of companies, just as he writes for the commercial theatre and for the court. So you've got a number of plays here that I've been alluding to that would have been performed Epicene, East Ho, by boy actors, entirely boy actor companies. Now, that's kind of interesting for all kinds of things. I mean, there's a dozen lectures that could be given on that, about how that changes what's possible. It almost seems as though the repertoire for those companies could almost push at the edges of the envelope even more. They could afford to be, they were very satirical. They tended to push at the edges of sort of generic expectation. They became very associated with satire and satirical drama. They were sort of quite edgy in what they were prepared to do. Is that something that having all boys actually made slightly more possible, and that almost everything gets hyped up? So Epicene is a play, as its name might suggest, about gender. And about gender. So if you've got boys playing all of the parts, from older men to women, young women, older women, the whole thing becomes a kind of hyper-real performance. It's very, very self-conscious. So Lucy Munro's done some fantastic work on the children's companies. There's some really great, great work out there. And there's a whole sort of story to tell about the acting styles, about the kinds of plays that started to be written for them, and how the adult companies reacted to that and started to shift some of their own practices as well.
Thank you. Another question? Here we are.
Hi, Elspeth North. I was just wondering if you had anything to, or you knew anything about the Mermaid Tavern and the intellectual circles going on there, and whether that had an influence on the plays. I'm particularly interested in the relationship with Dunn and Johnson, and anything you might enlighten us with that.
Yeah, so I mentioned someone associated with the Mermaid Tavern being involved in that deed purchase, so around the gatehouse. We know that Johnson is very heavily involved, one of many different kinds of circles that Johnson moves in. So that's, so you can't really talk about Johnson's circle, because he has all these overlapping groups. A number of his poems that pick up on the kinds of dialogues and debates that are going on at the Mermaid Tavern. And there's some interesting plaques that are owned by RBS now, of all things, the site, with some wonderful objects in there. Misha O'Callaghan's written about that in a book I edited a while ago. So you've got another network there. Inns of Court figures, of course, and with Dunn, you've got that connection. So you've got these overlappings of different communities all the time. Ex-Westminster School associates of Johnson. You know, it's quite a complex geography. And I really think in this world in which we talk a lot about networks and we're fascinated by social networks, that there is work to be done on a really serious database of what the sort of networks were and who was crisscrossing. But I think the sort of the intellectual dinner, albeit a very drunken exercise often, something like that described in Inviting a Friend to Supper, the great Johnson poem, is a really important force of sociability and force of politics at this time that we can. Andy Hadfield's done a little bit of work on that. There's a sort of growing body. I'm really interested in the Johnson-Dunn connection. Johnson was a great reader of Dunn, and by that I mean not just that I think he sat there and read him a lot. I think he really felt attuned to what Dunn was writing, so much so that in 1629, when he writes that play I mentioned called The New Inn, he quotes Dunn in there. He uses a poem called The Calm for a very beautiful, very poignant moment in the play. So he's, you know, even late in his life, is sort of reworking Dunn in very conscious ways. He picks Dunn out when he's in the informations, the so-called conversations with Drummond, however trustworthy they are. He's there as a presence. So I think that circle, Dunn, of course, takes us as well into the Alleyne family, and you know, there again we've got these fascinating links between Bankside, Inns of Court, the church, the sermon and the pulpit as another site of performance. It's just, it's all going on. And when people do work on, say, Victorian London, there's that sense that there's all of this simultaneous activity, and I want to try and get a little bit of that richness and texture back into the account of early modern London, which can sometimes divide up in, you know, you always have a chapter on the Blackfriars, a chapter on the Bankside, and there the twain shall meet somehow. And I think these groups are just mixing and matching. And when you get Dunn and you get the Inns of Court groups, they're also reaching out into the provinces, because these people are travelling to and from, coming up for the London season, going back to provincial estates. So the regions and the different regional identities of England in particular become also a really important part of the story, and I don't want to forget about them in thinking about the city, because it seems to me they flow in and out in important ways as well. Long answer, sorry.
That's a great answer, thanks very much. Another one.
Hello, yes, David Belsey. I wonder if you could say a little bit about the presence in Blackfriars and Bankside of printers, booksellers, other ways in which reading matter was both distributed and also accessed.
Yes, so again, part of those networks that we need to think about are very much the sort of printing houses and the companies, and particularly the Blackfriars play. Johnson writes a whole play in 1626, the staple of news, 1625-26, the staple of news, which is about the print houses, full of lots of allusions to butter and so on. But if you also look at the printers he's working with around that time, and then who else they are printing. And Early English Books Online is a wonderful resource for that, because you can type in these years and then see what someone has sort of published as a body of work. And it starts to connect up groups that, again, because of genre or because of other ways of working, we might have thought of rather separately. It's also, print is being picked up in different forms, from a beautiful folio text to quarto plays to octavos to ballads and petty, chapbooks and so on. So there's different ways in which, I suppose, print is mobile and part of the sort of kinetic movement of these neighbourhoods. Johnson is fascinated by this all the time, those kind of textual presences, quite literally. But I think of the printers' shops as themselves gathering spaces, as sites of dialogue and exchange. So I think I've spent a bit on the publisher of the New Inn, particularly in 1629 to 31, and what was happening there. And you get these little insights into neighbourhoods. I haven't particularly done a lot around the sort of 1604 to 1612 moment, but that would be really interesting. I've been much more locked into the Caroline period of late. But you're right, there's another whole connecting matrix, if you like, of what's going on.
Thanks very much. Another question? There are. Thanks.
Hi, I was the husband mentioned earlier. You've talked a lot about the interplay and the exchange of ideas. What about the exchange of insults that was going on between the playwrights? Because as I understand it, there was quite a war of words at one stage between the two different sets of playwrights.
Yeah, so the War of the Theatres, which I think has been the product of many books and many theses, and I think you can see a bit of commercialism at play in that as well. I mean, they're a bit like that reference in A Chase Made in Cheapside that I ended up with, where you've got the Swan Theatre, an outdoor theatre, referring to the repertoire of another theatre, of a different kind of rival. They're very conscious all the time of what other companies are doing, what other writers are doing. So there was this War of the Theatres, and it did get nasty. I mean, some of those references to Johnson the bricklayer, which come through in Satyromastics and this whole kind of moment. Nevertheless, I think there's also a lot of these writers then appear to be working with each other, sometimes within months. So there's a little bit of game playing as well in that too. I think the repertoire is one of very conscious rivalry, of very conscious cross-referencing. It's a hothouse environment. And the other thing you can see is that people find something that's working and will sort of pursue that to death. It's a bit like the Waterstones, if you like this, you want to read that. If you like Ian Rankin, you'll love Peter Robinson. It's that kind of thing. I think they're sort of sparking off each other. So, yes, I think there were some deep-seated rivalries, but I think as well that became a sort of way, this sort of backbiting and verbal fencing. And a lot of plays really enjoy that repartee. And you even get some plays where you see characters being trained in how to do it, in how to do verbal fencing. It's a wonderful Richard Broom play where a sort of extended dance kind of happens on the stage where they learn to insult each other. So there's a kind of sense that people got trained at how to do that as well. If you insult someone, you also actually advertise them, which kind of interests me. So I'm sort of interested in how repertoire talks to repertoire and what might happen. And so, yes, sometimes I think it's deep-seated and quite insulting, and other times I think there's a bit of game playing going on.
Thanks very much. Another question over there. Thank you.
Hi, Sue Jones. I'm very interested in the Thames as a space, and I'm particularly interested in John Taylor, the Waterman poet, who modelled himself in a kind of half-hearted sort of way on Johnson. But I just wondered, you mentioned the Waterman quite a few times, and I wondered if you've done any work on the Waterman, but also the Thames as performative space, because particularly even with water pageants, but even during frost fairs where they had the bear baiting on the Thames. And I find it really interesting as that space that broaches the division between Bankside and Blackfriars.
Absolutely. So Taylor's a bit of an obsession anyway at the moment, because he also walks to Scotland in literally tracking Johnson at various points, and they meet up in Leith, which is a very strange moment in 1618. But I've also got a very wonderful PhD student working at the moment who is also Arts and Humanities Research Council funded, Jemima Matthews, who's doing a cultural geography of the Thames at exactly this moment. So yes, the frost fairs are wonderful and get referenced a lot in the plays, and you can start to date some things by those. They had camels as well at various points. 1632, they definitely had dromedaries on the Thames. The watermen are really fascinating in a number of ways. Taylor, of course, gives us kind of insight into that world, almost kind of unionised defence against the coming of the coaches and various other things I mentioned. But there were lots, as you say, lots of other kinds of performances. I got very fascinated. There's a whole series of pamphlets when some of the flooding of the Thames happens, which is almost described as a kind of tidal bore that happened, you know, before all the Thames floodgates were put in. And the watermen, of course, know the water, and they become the harbingers of that. And they play these games of sort of sticks, watching how they turn, and then warn people that the big floods are coming. So they're quite powerful in the pamphlet culture of the time as well. There are all sorts of things. There's a submarine that is floated down by Drebbel, and again, the staple of news makes reference to that. The Thames seems to have been active in all kinds of ways. So, yeah, you had the annual Lord Mayor's pageant with its sort of amphibious scenes. You had sea battles being played out. You had sometimes when sort of whales and large fish sort of got trapped in the waterway, people would come out, and that was a kind of spectatorial sport as well. I spoke recently at the Queen's House in Greenwich about just audiences on the Thames side and how regular practice that was. I'm sort of struck by how often people gathered on the waterside and on London Bridge to watch things on the water of varying degrees of spectacle, really. So I think it was absolutely, as you say, an alternative site for theatre and very consciously thought of in that way by people of all different backgrounds and echelons. So really rich material, I think, on the Thames. There is some good material still in the Waterman's archives yet to be unpacked, so I think there's still some really great research projects out there to come. And Taylor himself is just a subject in himself, a great traveller and voyager, and of course does things in paper boats which sink and all manner of madcap things. He was the first great performance artist, I think. He knew that doing strange installation art would get you attention.
Thanks very much. Another question? Just mentioned that we're talking about the river and getting back and forth across it. Jeff Marsh, who's the head of the Department of Theatre and Performance here, tells me that there is a wherry, which is the name of the kind of boat that you used, somewhere or other in London that's been restored or is available to look at somewhere. Does anybody know about it? I can't quite remember what he said. A wherry. Right. Great word. Any other questions? James.
Hi, James Wallace. I was just curious, you showed a picture of, there was lots of different things on a piece of paper, including a layout of a theatre seating stage. I just wondered what that was.
The mask one, yes. So that's a drawing of a mask performance. So it's the layout for the audience and the perspectival position of the king.
Do you know where that would have...
Sorry?
Of an actual performance?
Yes.
Was that, where was that?
So that's, I think if I remember right, that's Mask of Queens. I can double check for you, yeah.
I think that's the one we're looking at in the moment, isn't it? No?
No, this is Coelum Britannicum. This is a sliding shutter that would have appeared
that was
at the back of the mask.
Stage scenery, right. Okay.
Me. So you've got this white hull. So this is royal. So, you know, somewhat different. But I always find it really interesting that Johnson is therefore writing with these different spaces. And Bartholomew Fair is really interesting because it's performed at the Hope one night and then seemingly at the Court the next night. Different prologue for each because you adapt it to suit your audience. But things are portable as well. So when we talk about a Blackfriars play, it's being written with spaces in mind, but it's also being written with flexibility in mind, that it might be taken out on tour, that it might be played in a provincial estate, that it will play at the Globe and at the Blackfriars increasingly. So I need to be careful that you don't just pin something down to one site. These things are flexible and they change and adapt across spaces as well.
As we know, a lot of plays toured around the country, and Andy Gurr has written quite a lot about this, so they had to be adaptable to space, didn't they, I guess. Yeah. Do we have some more questions? A final one, maybe? I just wanted to say that a recollection, really, about the beginning of this project, when I was walking around London tracking these the propinquity, you know, of places, theatres, these various sites, with Peter Sillito, it's our full-time postdoctoral research associate, you can't be here today. And it was just astonishing to discover that, for instance, Johnson, who would have been working, as you say, at the Blackfriars, it would take 10 minutes to walk from the Blackfriars to the Middle Temple. And we know that there's quite a cache of signed copies of Johnson's works or put from his library in the Middle Temple library. So he must have spent a lot of time walking back and forth between those two sites, just as one example, I think.
The other thing I loved, I did a walk some years ago now with Sue Wiseman, who's at Birkbeck College, around the Blackfriars thing, and was sort of, I was very interested because I was working on in an edition of the New Inn at the time in St Andrews by the Wardrobe and the kind of proximity of those spaces. But then we suddenly turned a corner, we got slightly lost and went down a tiny little alley, and suddenly we stepped out and we were actually on walking on sort of mussels and shells, and we were on Blackfriars Wharf, and the proximity of that, and suddenly realising that all of that activity of the loading and unloading of cargo, the sense is, you know, so close again. And there's a global geography that opened up. I mean, Richard Mabey has done wonderful work about how on the timbers that were strewn there, different kinds of plant life and flora and fauna that had come on the ships from around the world. But, you know, there were the sights and smells, multiple languages, the different ship workers, those canvas climbers that Joyce mentioned in that quote at the beginning become incredibly resonant, and they're absolutely moments away from each other, which is just really rich and interesting.
Fantastic. Yep, marvellous. So are we done with our questions? Well, maybe we can thank our speaker today, but in the usual way. Thanks very much. Thank you very much, Julie. I'd just like to mention, as Julie's mentioned once or twice, about future speakers. The next speaker in two weeks a day is a very distinguished, also distinguished student and teacher of this period, Tiffany Stern from Oxford. And she's going to speak, it's kind of adjacent to today's talk, really, very much so. You probably picked up a flyer about it. Stuck up and down about the city playbills in Shakespeare's London. Andy can say more about this at some time, but the adverts that were put up on posts and so forth could be very like the actual pages, the printed pages of play quartos that came out in the same period. So there's all sorts of adjacencies again between the geography of London, the plays themselves, and this is another one. And I hope to see you again next time. Thanks very much.